for WFHB in Bloomington, this is Hereabouts,
a collaboration with the IU Asian Culture Center.
This is Akshat Gupta, producer on Hereabouts. Today, you'll hear part one of my interview with our guest, Eric Langowski, a fourth-generation Japanese-American undergraduate student at Indiana University and former staffer at our own Asian Culture Center. Eric is a board member of the Hoosier chapter of the Japanese-American Citizens League and is currently studying IU's World War II-era ban on admitting Japanese-Americans in conjunction with America's decision to incarcerate 120,000 Japanese-Americans throughout World War II. Today, we'll hear about this dark chapter of American history and how it is echoed by recent events, such as the separation of migrant children from their families at the border. Part two of this interview, which will air at a later date, will examine the legacy of IU's decision and its impact today. We're here now with Eric Langowski, just recently graduated from Indiana University. Congratulations, Eric.
Thank you.
And he's here to speak with us about IU and Japanese Americans through a historical lens. So, Eric, you weren't really a history student. You were a math major, is that correct?
That's correct.
So tell us a bit about how you got interested in doing this sort of archival research on something as seemingly obscure as the admissions and enrollment history at Indiana University.
Yeah, so I think for me, I've always been really engaged with this history because the history of Japanese Americans in America is also my family history. And I kind of found, as I was going through at IU, I kept getting more involved in working on events, working at the Asian Culture Center. And I found out through that entire process that I just didn't have an extremely strong background on the specific history and the relationships between all of the different events that happened in World War II, which was when America decided to incarcerate everyone of Japanese ancestry from the West Coast. So when I found out in my last semester here in January that IU had a very specific relationship with this history, where in fact they had participated in the larger scheme of discrimination against Japanese Americans, I'm that kind of in a sense forced me to become some kind of historian to understand that history and to tell that history.
Right, that's fascinating. So before telling us about your research itself and the enrollment and admissions process, tell us a bit about the historical context. Our listeners might know that vaguely about the Japanese-American incarceration during World War II, but some racist policies existed before the war as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, so kind of in America, you have this history of anti-Asian sentiment and anti-Asian policies, which kind of distinguishing that into two things. So there's laws and literal policies of discrimination, and then there's sentiments and kind of opinions of racism or nativism and everything that comes with that. So you see that in America, there's an influx of Chinese immigration in the 19th century. And then there's a strong backlash to that, and you see all Chinese immigration basically be banned or stopped on the federal level in 1882. And then after that, you see Japanese begin to immigrate. There were maybe 1,000 Japanese that had immigrated to the United States before 1890, and in a few short years after the Chinese were blocked from immigrating, you see this influx of Japanese immigration. And then with that, you kind of see a switch from anti-Chinese sentiment in California and in America to anti-Japanese sentiment. So then instead of you see a similar focus on immigration laws, where eventually Japanese are basically banned from immigrating. It started in the early 20th century. But due to some differences in who immigrated, the Japanese population in America was much more evenly divided between men and women. So they were able to have offspring, and very quickly, by 1940, the majority was American-born in the Japanese population. But that kind of trend there led to an entirely different kind of scheme of anti-Japanese sentiment, where many nativists were worried about the physical reproduction of Japanese and wanted to prevent this quote yellow peril or yellow onslaught of a huge amount of Asians kind of taking over America. You see someone in
starting from the west coast,
starting from the west coast.
I see.
You see someone wrote an article in the newspaper that projected there'd be 20 million Asians in 2062. They did this in like 1930 or 1940. And that was different than the immigration policies, which were primarily laws. Now you have this goal of making kind of eliminating the ability of Japanese to be economically successful, to reproduce, to kind of have these families. And you see California begin to go through and pass laws that are more restrictive than to people that are already in America. So throughout this entire time period, of course, only whites and blacks are allowed to naturalize. So anyone, no matter how long they've lived in America, if you were born in China or Japan, even if you're one or two, you could never naturalize. So within that scheme, you see rights that are traditionally given to Americans being denied to those populations. Mm. So starting in 1924 and 1913, California begins to restrict the ability of Issei, or first generation Japanese Americans who were born in Japan and then immigrated, to own land, to bank, to own businesses, and kind of that anti-Japanese sentiment, where you see rights that are traditionally given to everyone in America be eroded based only on race, is important in the general scheme of Japanese American incarceration in World War II.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that brings us to the point up to World War II and Japanese American incarceration in the early 1940s. I believe it's about 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry were incarcerated by 1942. Can you tell us a bit more about Executive Order 9066?
Yeah, so after Pearl Harbor happened, and I guess an important point to make, the conversation we just had, is that anti-Asian and anti-Japanese sentiment didn't start with Pearl Harbor. Right. It started basically the onset of immigration. After Pearl Harbor started, you kind of immediately saw prominent military and government officials make claims of fifth column activity, or in other words, and that traditionally means, there's a good cartoon by Dr. Seuss, which kind of characterizes every Japanese person as looking to home for orders to attack America. But the fifth column idea basically is kind of, it lines up perfectly with the yellow peril,
subversion,
kind of nativism
from within,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to attacks from outside the country.
So yeah, so once you kind of saw, I mean, and it's been theorized that, like, the Secretary of Navy, I think, said that Pearl Harbor was promoted by the strongest fifth column attack he'd ever seen. And and at the time he said that, he knew that Pearl Harbor was because of America's military failures and the failure to defend the base. It had nothing to do with anyone of Japanese ancestry. Famously, there's never been, even now when we look back at the historical record, one kind of documented instance of sabotage by anyone of who was Japanese American.
Yeah.
So kind of this initial period after Pearl Harbor, before incarceration, from December 1941 to February 1942, you see that kind of sentiment build up and those kind of accusations be hurled. Every community leader, if you were a minister or a teacher or some kind of lawyer, anyone who basically was an established community leader in the Japanese American community at that time, was immediately rounded up because they were at risk of kind of leading this community to attack America or some sort of perverted argument like that. So you very quickly, after Pearl Harbor, you have the situation where the majority of the Japanese American community leaders in the Issei, so those who are not citizens who immigrated, are removed. So a lot of families that don't have their fathers anymore. And then you also see the assets of the community be frozen. So my grandmother had to withdraw from college because of the bank accounts being frozen.
Right.
And then you also see kind of this attack on the constitutional rights, where the Department of Justice basically gave a blanket search warrant to any house that had an issei in it to look for contraband. And contraband was defined as like fishing rods and radios and scissors and knives. So it wasn't, it was basically anything that anyone would have in their house.
Yeah, blank check sort of to search. So you have a personal story in this as well. There's an incarceration story in your family history, and you just alluded to your grandmother. Can you tell us a bit more about what your grandmother was doing at the time and how she was affected by the policies and sort of the anti-Japanese sentiment of the time?
Yeah, so at this time in 1941, my grandmother was my age right now. She was just about to complete her sophomore year in junior college. Mm-hmm. So she was very similar to many of us at IU today and the college students like that. So her kind of relationship with this history, is kind of a sad one, but they had to do the traditional, you can only take what you can carry. So she always talks about how she just loved the piano that she had. And it was like it was like the nicest thing that her family ever owned. And she never saw it again after she had to leave in early 1942. So my grandmother had to withdraw from college. She worked for the California equivalent of the Department of Motor Vehicles and this is a famous event. Every single employee of the California government that was of Japanese ancestry was fired with the same letter. Mm. She still has that letter today. And then kind of the first stage of incarceration was something the government called an assembly center. And her assembly center was Santa Anita Horse Racing Track. Her address became a horse racing track. She always said she was lucky to not live in the horse stalls because some people ended up living in the horse stalls. And
so they would house people in the horse stalls itself.
Yeah, they would. Yeah. You have to think about this, just the scale of this incarceration, how the government basically had to overnight build assembly centers or prisons for 100,000 people, and they weren't very prepared and they weren't very organized. So you kind of basically see them, at least in this case, they picked a horse racing track, they put a barbed wire fence around it, they had people with guns patrol the fence, and everyone was just kind of in the middle trying to establish some sort of like little home for themselves. And some people got a horse racing stall, some people got a barrack built on the grounds of the track. So it was just kind of a free-for-all. But yeah, so that was the assembly center stage. And so I think my grandmother, her mother and her father, her father wasn't important enough, I think she would say, to be incarcerated separately. So the family got to stay together. And they were there for 2 or 3 months, and then eventually they got their orders. They didn't really know where they were going, but they got their orders, and they ended up going to Amachi, Colorado, which is in southeastern Colorado, kind of in a high plain. It's not exactly a desert, but it's kind of like a scrub brush. So, mm-hmm. Once she went there, her father got sick, and kind of within a few months, he died. So whenever I think about this history, I always think about how, and for him, you could say that his sentence was death, or his incarceration was permanent. He died incarcerated. He died without freedom. And the government did apologize in 1988, but for everyone that didn't make it to 1988 that was incarcerated, they wouldn't hear that apology. So, you can even frame it as his crime was his race, or his crime was being Japanese.
Just the accident of where he was born.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you think of the crime being your ancestry and the punishment being death. And that's not something we traditionally associate with American democracy, but
justice, yeah. So your grandmother got relocated to this other center. And at what point did incarceration stop for her?
Yeah. So she was, she would probably say she was one of the lucky ones. And this relates to my research focus, but she was able to go to Baker University in Kansas fairly quickly in the incarceration. So I think she was only incarcerated for about a year, and then she went to college for the rest of the war. But kind of related to that, you couldn't really go back, so she didn't get to see her family the entire time she was in college either, except for one time she gave my great uncle, her younger brother, an orange because she like waited on the train platform. They got released from Amachi and they moved to Chicago, but she stayed in Kansas to finish college. So that was like the one time that she got to see her family in the war period. So
perhaps a lot of people don't realize the sort of scope of the internment, as you mentioned, how many people were incarcerated and the degree to which it was extrajudicial, of course. And, you know, some people, I suspect, might just question or believe that, well, you know, why wasn't there any resistance or how could there not be much resistance? When I think perhaps the reality is what sort of resistance could actually have been effective, right? And there was almost a feeling, I remember from your presentation, you said there was almost a sense of helplessness among the community, that there's nothing really that can be done about this situation, right? What's the phrase for this in Japanese?
Shikata ga nai. Yeah, it cannot be helped, or it must be done. Yeah, no. So, I mean, the Japanese Americans at the time, they had it pretty tough. So, I mean, we all know of decisions like Korematsu and Hirabashi and all the court cases the Japanese Americans lost. But more importantly, you see that the framing around incarceration was kind of, if you go quietly, you're a patriot. If you don't, you're not. Because kind of this was part of the war effort. The military was running the camps and built the camps at the beginning of the war. They eventually handed it to civilian control, and not for a little bit of time. So if you think about the fact that on one hand, there's these basically blanket searches going against every single Japanese American household, looking for all this contraband and everything like that. You have the community leaders, 2,000 of them rounded up, and no one knows where they are or what's going on with them. And you kind of have this idea, which is expressed by a lot of the Nisei, which that's my grandmother's second generation Japanese Americans, that concentration camps is kind of the best they could hope for. It's better than being killed or being sent back to Japan. So kind of within that framework, you don't have this idea of resistance that we would say today where people would just refuse to go, but you have kind of the military being used in conjunction with the Constitution being ignored against Japanese Americans, and there wasn't really any possible recourse that could be found. So the people that didn't like it, the government deported thousands of people. You could check a little box that says, I don't want to be in America anymore, and they'd kick you out. Because in some ways that was kind of what the public opinion at the time wanted was.
Right. And there was a loyalty questionnaire as well, right? With the very questionable sort of language. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, no, the loyalty questionnaire. Basically, the loyalty questionnaire was a questionnaire that everyone had to fill out, and it asked you some questions which were difficult for Japanese Americans to fill out. So one of them was, do you renounce all loyalty to the Japanese emperor, the Japanese government, and kind of along those lines? And for the Issei, who they weren't American citizens, they worried if they answered yes to this question that they would have citizenship of no country, because they were essentially renouncing their Japanese citizenship and they weren't allowed to get American citizenship. And then the other question was, which focused on kind of the willingness of serving in the military. And you have a lot of people think about, well, we're incarcerated behind barbed wire and the military has guns and they're pointing them at us. Why would we want to serve in the military? Why would I want to serve in the military if they're going to incarcerate I have a young daughter or my sister, or my mother or my grandmother who can barely even walk. So you have all of those questions are presented to every single person incarcerated, and any other answer except yes, I will renounce my citizenship, or yes, I will renounce any loyalty to the Japanese government, and yes, I will serve in the military, meant that you were labeled as disloyal. And they sent everyone that, they call them no-no boys, they sent everyone that said no to one or either of the questions to a different camp called Tule Lake, which was the worst one. And that was one where the guards would occasionally shoot and kill people who were doing something they didn't like. So.
Right, right. You said the government did formally apologize in What year was it again? Can you tell me?
So it was kind of this process that started in 1976 and ended in 1988. So the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, signed by President Reagan, was the kind of the culmination where Japanese Americans were the one group to get reparations, and they got their apology from the government. So my grandmother got a $20,000 check in the mail for all of her troubles. And you kind of see that as the federal government acknowledging a wrong or trying to right a wrong. But of course, we know that American history is full of many wrongs which have not been corrected. So
yeah, and many repetitions as well, because a lot of what you've been speaking about echoes of nativist sentiment or anti-immigrant sentiment that exists to this day.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you see just in the news in the last week the separation of children from their families when they're trying to claim refugee status in this country, and then the concentration or incarceration of the children in these kind of old Walmart buildings. So there are a lot of parallels today of the American government, which even you see that sometimes, I know that the current presidential administration has cited some of the Supreme Court cases from Japanese Americans in World War II as precedent for something related to Guantanamo Bay. But you kind of see that this history is still part of the legal American canon, where military necessity, or now we call it national security, right, can be used to justify actions which are inconscionable.
That was Eric Langowski speaking to us about Japanese-American incarceration and the family separation policy by this administration. I also spoke to Eric about Indiana University's admissions ban on Japanese-American students, which we will air at a later date. Now, here is part two of our interview with Vimala Pongsavan, Public Policy Director of the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum, who spoke about our civic responsibility to participate in the democratic process.
The one thing I get really most passionate about is that, you know, politicians work for the people. You know, now we see a lot of politicians really taking advantage of the system, or are just, you know, they're put on this pedestal that that needs to be brought down, because at the end of the day, people vote them in, and that's where our democracy is most powerful, is that we can also vote them out. Yeah. And that's how you change laws, is with policymakers who are willing to push different policies or not push certain policies. And so it's just a way to really hold people accountable. And with racial justice, I mean, I've always been sometimes at the table as the only woman, sometimes as the only Asian American. And so it's always been something that I think about when I sit at those tables and advocate for, is why aren't there more people who are here speaking on these issues that are affected by the issues? And so I've always fought to have more representation on different commissions to different levels of government, because we can't continue to keep having the same people make decisions for other people. And so I think as long as there is a voice at that table pushing that agenda, the world and just in general, there will just be more representation, better decisions that are made. It might be a longer process, but it'll be more genuine. Diversity drives innovation, and mm-hmm. That's where you get, you know, the best ideas are from different types of people sitting at a table with each other, instead of, you know, the same types with the same experiences. So yeah, that's always been something that I've pushed for, especially both of them, right? Having mm-hmm. more people of color in office to make decisions is just the goal here.
Yeah, we should have people that represent every single type of person in the country, especially when they talk about the U.S. being such like a melting pot, yeah, and like a salad bowl and stuff.
Well,
like
yeah,
that.
Especially like if you're in, like I think of the school system, right? And if you're in an urban district, there's, you know, lots of students of color. Mm-hmm. You know, teachers have to reflect what the student body looks like. It can't be all just white teachers who, I mean, you need to have teachers who understand students, who understand mm-hmm. like where these students are coming from, because then they're able to teach better. Then you're able to really relate to the needs of the students. But
yeah, also Asian American issues aren't really often spoken about in many places across the U.S., especially as they intersect with gender. So how do you think we can work together as a country to dismiss many myths and stereotypes about Asian American women?
Yeah, I think there's a real need to organize around these issues because, like you said, it's a very invisibilized community in a lot of the public policy discussions. And, you know, we fight for dispelling the model minority myth, which is the idea that Asian Americans are doing well, that we're highly educated, that we have really good jobs. And a lot of that's not true for a lot of the different Asian communities. I mean, it's a big and diverse community. We have over 50 different ethnicities. We speak over 100 different languages. Everyone has a different experience coming to this country. And so we need to really tell stories better. We need to tell stories of the communities that have been invisibilized so that, you know, we can get the communities that are most at risk, the resources they need. And so that's a danger in not being visible, is that these communities are not getting the resources that they need. And so, yeah, so what we work on is really, we work on fighting for data disaggregation so that we can see the different ethnic groups broken down and what, you know, their needs are, whether it's in education, whether it's in health, whether it's in economic justice, that doesn't really represent the different experiences of all Asian Americans.
Yeah. Also, we talked about this a little bit beforehand, but Asian American and Pacific Islander Equal Pay Day just passed on February 22nd, which I know you are very passionate about. I looked on your Twitter and stuff. So what are your thoughts on this? And do you think this means that racial equality in the workplace has been earned for Asian Americans? Or is this only the beginning of fair treatment?
I believe it's only the beginning of fair treatment. So Equal Pay Day was a day that that we observed. We were the leading organization in organizing the work. Mainly, so we had... we did three events, one in D.C., one in Atlanta, and then one in Chicago. And then we also had like a big Twitter storm. And the main part of it, the main piece of it was telling the stories of a very diverse community from, you know, the different experience of factory workers to restaurant workers, nail salon workers. And when you think of those... like just those three different types of workplace experiences, those are very different and they're all different. I mean, I think why I'm most passionate about it is when I think of my mother who came here in 1981 and her second day of work was at a factory and she just retired last year from that factory. So it's 35, 36 years later. Earning the minimum wage throughout. Even at her retirement, she was still earning the minimum wage and not getting paid sick time, paid family leave, not getting vacation time. And, you know, sometimes working 16 hours a day when I was growing up. And so that really drives me to want to change workplace environment. Also wants me, I want to pass policies that are fair. But, you know, everyone's experience is very different.
Yeah.
In there.
Yeah, I agree.
So we still have a lot to work on.
I agree with that. So finally, what advice would you give to any young people who want to become leaders in the future and who want to become more involved in the current political environment, but are perhaps too apprehensive or don't really know where to begin?
Yeah, you know, just get involved. You start off by just register to vote, because when you get that ballot, I mean, there it could be 10 pages long, it could be a page long, and they'll name the different issues. But don't get too worried about that part of it. And just get involved.
You've been listening to Hereabouts.
Hereabouts is produced with the IU Asian Culture Center and broadcast from WFHB in Bloomington. Our theme music is by Eternal Youth.
Tune in to Hereabouts every other week from 5:30 to 6 on Wednesdays right here on WFHB.